hello, and welcome to the Ethos of Aid podcast. My name is Kimber, and I'm your host. This week, I'm blending narratives from northern Pakistan and Canada within my own family to underline one of the key themes in this podcast, which is helping is complicated. If you're enjoying what you're hearing, please let me know, either at kimbervredenburg.com or at kimbervredenburg on Instagram or on the Ethos of Aid Facebook page. Let's get started. Helping is complicated. Are you getting that impression? Are these episodes highlighting those complexities as well as the opportunities, I hope? It may be hard to believe, but as we learn when we study to become human service workers, every human being has a different meaning for every word they choose. Those meanings are grounded in the experiences they've had, the beliefs and values in which they've been raised in their families of origin and in cultures of origin, as well as significant events that shape those meanings, traumas, and all of those experiences are at play in human beings, regardless of their level of awareness of it. And as you've heard me say, if we're talking about helping, we're talking about change. And if we're talking about change, we're talking about changes in behavior. And changes in behavior necessarily involve changes in thoughts, feelings, beliefs, and values. And all of this is going on in humanitarian work, even though we don't talk about it often. Beliefs, values, and norms live in the subconscious mind, which directs our behavior, which has been ingrained in there through repetition over years and decades. And so even if new information is presented with a change agenda, if it's not paired with new feeling, it stays in the conscious mind. Information alone doesn't change behavior. Remember the description of the 28 pastoralists turned health workers in episode 2? Their perceptions of mental health and their subsequent change in behavior towards the mothers in our program was possible because they made an emotional connection to the concept of mental health through relating it to their own experience. They freed themselves of the old belief and the stigma that went with it that said mental health was something to fear. There's a lot more to say here, but hopefully this alone gives you some idea of the complexities of helping another human or group of humans. Think about that for just a moment. You say you want to help someone. How can you ever know the best way to help them without knowing the lens through which you're looking, listening, and defining whatever the problem is, and understanding the lens through which they see the issue? Do they even see the issue? We have to first know ourselves and then be able to put that aside to meet people where they are and find out the best way to help. Cross-cultural work exacerbates all of these factors. Within a context, it's possible to make some assumptions of shared beliefs and values, social norms. As you've heard Julius Kwame Tsatsu from Ghana when he described Ghanaian people. And then within that, of course, there are many variations, different groups, subgroups, and individuals. And so as an international practitioner, I must be aware of all of the complexities that make up who I am to be able to meet all of the individuals I will connect with in a context outside of my culture of origin. And as I described in Malawi, it's a privilege to be in the position to actually help someone. So I continually ask myself if I'm aware of the power differential between that privilege I hold and the person who's receiving help. I'm continually striving to put myself in the position of what it's like to need help, so that I can ensure that I'm leveling the difference between the position of helper and receiver of help. It's complicated. Years ago, I did cross-cultural leadership courses with youth, and the thing that always surprised them was that people who had less material wealth didn't want us to feel sorry for them. And all it took for that awareness to be generated was me asking them if it felt good to them when somebody pitied them. That question always resulted in a resounding no. And it also shone a light on the very perception that material wealth and valuing of having material wealth was, in fact, a choice they were making to value that certain thing over something else, and that it was based in their privilege and cultural context. So in light of what I've discussed here and asked here around how we can really know what someone needs in terms of help, zoom the lens back out for a second to the humanitarian system where you've heard me describe decisions being made outside of context. In episode 7 last week in Sierra Leone, I talked about the fact that the organizations creating the policies for reintegrating child combatants did not think about the fact that during their reintegration process, those children would need residential care that would have to be staffed by the very Sierra Leonean adults against whom those children had committed atrocities during the war. And as such, we would be a long way from best practices for children were we not to create space for those Sierra Leonean staff to process their own experiences before taking up that care. Without being in the field and really understanding our context and the people within it, we can't really know what's needed. It's really easy to solve problems on paper or at a distance, but without awareness of the lens through which one is defining problems, and without being on the ground with the people affected by those problems and those serving the people affected from context, we can't really know. There's always a bigger picture. Here's the narrative I want to share. Years ago, my youngest child came home from school so excited to share with me that their class was reading a book about a local NGO who claimed to have successfully removed thousands of children from the child labor industry in northern Pakistan. As it happens, I worked in northern Pakistan right after September 11th in the northwest frontier province. The class was studying this organization, and the founders had written a book about their experiences, and the class was eating it up. They were well on board with the power of activism to eradicate child labor. I listened to my child describe what a wonderful initiative it was, and I saw how excited they were and inspired by the idea, and I thought to myself, at what point do I pop this bubble? I let them have their moment, and then I said, my darling, I love that you're inspired by this story, and I'm sure there is great work happening, and here's what I also need you to know. Helping is complicated, and the likelihood is that those children who are no longer making footballs are now making running shoes or carpets. I watched their little face fall a little, and then I saw them thinking, and then they began to ask me a lot of questions. I answered these questions and then took a bigger step. I got in touch with the teacher and created a presentation to go in and fill in some of the gaps in their perspective from a field-level humanitarian point of view. I introduced the concepts of beliefs and values and ethics with this group of enthusiastic 10-year-olds, and I asked them to think about what they believed and valued and where those came from in their families. I brought in the subjects of inequality and inequity, and this goes right back to episode 1 again, where I was also talking about the problems of abundance and the problems of deficiency. And I gave them this example. Fatima is a woman from Afghanistan. She's a mother of 4 and from a culture where she is not to leave her home in the absence of a male relative. It could be a brother, a father, a cousin, an uncle, or a grandfather, but it needs to be a male relative. try to hear that without judgment. It's a belief with a value and a social norm, and it is as valid as anything you, as a listener, believe and value. As a result of the war on terror that began after the Twin Towers went down on September 11th in New York City, Fatima now finds herself in neighboring Pakistan, having fled the bombing in her homeland. She's arrived with four children of her own, and she's picked up two en route who have become separated from their own families. There's not a male relative in sight. They are all either dead or still engaged in the fighting in Afghanistan. Fatima is now living in a tent in a refugee camp with these six children. And while humanitarian aid is on its way, there's always a gap in the time it takes for that aid to arrive. And everyone needs to eat. Not a male relative in sight. And to add to that, there are predatory male security services looking to exploit refugees. This is quite common. And Fatima's beliefs, values, and cultural norms, which have been ingrained in her since birth, dictate her behavior and the options available to her. And she has to feed her children and herself. And as always, swirling around in the midst of such contexts and emergencies are opportunists. In this case, the carpet weavers. Whether you know it or not, the handmade carpets you may adore are often made by children. Small fingers make tight knots. So what is Fatima to do? She takes in work from the carpet weavers, and the children go to work. This is what I explained to the children in my youngest child's class. Just as Machinjiri struggled to feed his family in Malawi in episode 1, here is Fatima trying to survive within the bounds of her cultural beliefs, values, and norms outside her own country. So while I loved the enthusiasm of the children in my child's class and really appreciated their indignance at the idea of any children having to work, I helped them see that whomever has enough food wins. And that's just a starting place. And helping is complicated. The United Nations Conventions on the Rights of the Child says the child is to be protected from economic exploitation and from performing any work that is likely to be hazardous or to interfere with the child's education, or to be harmful to the child's health or physical, mental, spiritual, moral, or social development. It goes on to say, this is not to say no child should work, but if children have to work or want to work, it should be safe, fairly paid, and should not interfere with their education. We know it's not as simple as eradicating child labor or any other social problem for that matter. It's complicated. There are many systems in place that perpetuate the inequity and inequality which contribute to these complexities. So in this case, what we can do is harm reduction. What this looks like is negotiating with whomever is supplying the children and families with work for time for children to also go to school and have time for recreation. As you can imagine, even that is quite a complex process because it involves trying to get people to care. In this case, to get those carpet weavers to care about the needs and rights of children. And while it may be a surprise, it's really true that there are many places in the world where the needs and rights of children simply aren't valued. So a lot of my work over the decades has been about creating ways to simply get people to care. And what that involves, as everything else I've said, is meeting people in their contexts and honoring their existing beliefs and values and looking for those places where I can help make an emotional connection to information which might lead to a change in behavior. I'm happy to say that some great harm reduction work takes place and took place in the context I'm describing. As I said, it's easy to armchair critique or solve problems from a distance, but it's entirely another thing to be on the ground working with the beliefs, values, and social norms that have defined a way of being for hundreds of thousands of years. To do this work well as international practitioners requires exceptional self-awareness, cultural competence, cross-cultural leadership, and a thorough understanding of how human change transpires, and how to work with contextual beliefs, values, and social norms to help people generate sustainable, internally guided social change. It's not a common perception, I'm afraid. One of my mentors and a great thought leader in the humanitarian community, Hugo Slim, recently published an article outlining the top skills needed in humanitarian aid workers for the 2021 context. None of these skills are on it. It's a great article, as is everything Hugo writes, in my opinion, and it's a comprehensive list of skills, and yet none of these human and social development skills are on it. And the absence of these skills indicates that even with all the current dialogue about localization, which aims to put more of the power and decision-making in humanitarian work into the hands of local governments, practitioners, and communities, there's still a gap in understanding that every wide-scale intervention necessarily involves an individual human-level change process as well, such as for someone like Fatima, or the practitioners I described in episode 7. Every human wants to be seen and held without being judged for their beliefs, values, and the social norms in which they've been raised, because we all want the space to live our lives free from scrutiny and exclusion on the basis of these things. Those are fundamental human rights as well, incidentally. So in my humble opinion, naturally, the approaches we take to helping in humanitarian work must also mirror those rights in the beliefs, values, and actions of the practitioners doing the work. Helping is complicated. Well, there you have it. Helping is complicated. And I really feel like I've only just scratched the surface. I hope you've enjoyed. I hope you've got lots to think about. And I really want to thank you for listening. And I would love to know what you're thinking about. So please do let me know at KimberVredenburg.com or at KimberVredenburg on Instagram or on the Ethos of Aid Facebook page. Till next time.